Hello and welcome to another Biology on the Beach. This is Dr. Leo Stouter speaking to you from Fort Lauderdale Beach. It's a beautiful day, nice sun and a few clouds. It's a good day to talk about genetics. As I'm sitting here in my beach chair, I notice that there is a family in front of me. It's a nice looking guy, nice looking female, and also one kid. And I'm looking at the kid, and he looks similar to the guy. He's got dark hair. But he also has a slender frame of the mother, whereas the guy tends to be a little huskier. So what I'm looking at is a combination of the genetics. I'm seeing that part of the genetics went across to the child from the father, and part went across from the mother as well. The kid is not the father, and the kid is not the mother, but rather a composite of the two. So when we look at the importance of genetics, we see the first thing that we can define or say is that genetics will help us to study the patterns of inheritance. As I just mentioned, those two aspects of the parents actually giving the child those genetic predispositions, if you will. Now, it can also be used for breeding purposes, such as you may have seen like purebred dogs. They're using genetics to make a pure line of the dog or the cat or whatever. Also, superior plants as well. You may have heard of hybrids. We have hybrid watermelons that have no seeds, so they genetically just took out the seeds. We also have seeds that are sold to farmers that are genetically programmed to shut off after they are used one time. So if you wanted to, for instance, plant, let's say, watermelon, and you plant the watermelon and then you sell the watermelon, well, some of those watermelons would have seeds in them. And genetically, they have cut those seeds off from being able to reproduce, so that the individual farmers then have to go back to the seed company and buy more seeds. They can't sort of do their own seeds because of the genetic manipulation that was done. Also, we can figure out whether or not what traits are in animals or traits are in us. So it's helpful for disease tracing or disease prevention even. If we have a genetic sort of predisposition to one disease or another, and we know that from our parents and from our ancestry, then we can deal with that. If we know we have genetic marker for heart disease, for instance, we may be aware of the things we can do for the heart, such as exercise, avoid smoking, and those kinds of things. Whereas if we don't have those markers, maybe we might be a little bit more lax in those areas. So it also answers questions of inheritance in families. So we can do a genetic analysis and figure out what are the probabilities of the next generation having a certain trait. And we can also look back and see how the genetics has affected the inheritant line. So we can sort of look at different things from the past and look at sort of what the future might hold as well. In the old days, we had some interesting comments, interesting thoughts. One of them was the human fruit tree. There was called the wakwak tree, and it was somewhere in Polynesia where no one ever went, so no one really knew if it existed or not. But the idea was that humans actually were born from a tree, and that seems very far-fetched, and who would believe that? But we even have that myth to today, and it's brought by with the stork. We know that we have a stork that brings a child, and the stork was actually one of the birds that are stork-like birds that would actually distribute the humans that fell off the wakwak tree. So that's an interesting genetic sideline, I guess. There's also spermatists, and the spermatists were individuals that believed that they could see a little human being in each sperm. So a sperm was containing a human being that did not have a soul yet, so they had to be sort of planted as if a seed would have to be planted. And you plant the seed in the female, then it's going to grow into an individual. So they felt like, for instance, if you have an apple seed, there's the essence of the apple inside that seed, and if you put it in good ground, it should grow into an apple tree, which would produce more apples. They felt that sperm contained a human being that just needed to be sort of grown in the garden of the female, and then, you know, that seed would then bear fruit, as it were. So they believed that, you know, the sperm actually contained an individual. Of course, we know that it contains half of the genetic information. It needs to be coupled with the female's half as well. Also, another phenomenon of historical interest is the Hasberg's lip, which is a famous inherited trait. And the lip was sort of like the Jay Leno lip, if you've ever seen a caricature of him. That sort of was a trait that was handed down. And the Hasbergs were royal, Holy Roman emperors. They were very, very prominent in, I believe, Germany. So these are just some of the ideas of the past, the genetic concepts and things that were seen and noticed. Now, Gregor was a genius, and his name was Gregor Genius Mendel. And Mendel was the founder of the science of modern genetics. And the modern genetics really is founded on a macro science, a big science, of actually seeing how things work in nature. So Gregor Mendel was a monk, and as a monk, he had an appreciation and a love for nature, as feeling that it was an expression of God. And he also had a passion for plants, and particularly one plant called the pea plant. So we can call him a peaceful man. Why the peas? Well, we chose a pea plant because the anatomy of the pea plant actually has a flower that is enclosed. You've probably seen snapdragons. Snapdragons are going to be a similar phenomenon. You have the snapdragon you can pull on either side or push on either side, and it'll open up, and then it'll close like the mouth of a dragon. Well, the pea plant has a very similar kind of arrangement. So why was that important? Well, what he wanted to do was cross-pollinate. He wanted to hand-pollinate one plant with another plant's genetics and see what happens. The inside of a plant has both a male and a female part to it. All that needs to happen is that you need to have the male part be sprinkled on the female part. So the male part is called the stamen, and you need to sprinkle the stamen, really the sperm, into the pestle, and the pestle is the female part. That's why bees are so important. It's because bees will actually be able to get, you know, they'll be collecting their pollen, and in that process they knock off the sperm that's on the stamen, and that then goes to the pestle, so it assists in pollination. Well, Mendel had the idea of removing the stamen from these plants so that that could not happen. So a like situation would not happen. So what he would do is he would take the stamen from, let's say, a purple flower, and which could yield more purple flowers. He would take the stamen off, and then he would dust or put the stamen onto the pestle of a white flower and see what happened. And likewise, he would take the white stamen and put it in the purple flower, the purple pestle, and see what happens there as well. And we did thousands and thousands and thousands of these hand pollinations. So you can see why it would be important for him to be a monk. He didn't have a family and he didn't have a wife, but he had lots of time to do his hand pollinations. So because he took so many thousands and thousands of these hand pollinations, his experiment didn't suffer from a sampling error. And as you remember, the term sampling error tells us it's going to be a problem with the amount of a certain experiment. If you just do it one or two times, it's suspect. But if you do it thousands of times, then you start to see a pattern that can be relied upon. Also, it turns out that the pea plant has a uniform sexual reproduction. Now, Mendel knew this, and this is one of the reasons why he picked the pea plant as well. What does uniform sexual reproduction mean? It means that it is uniform. That if you have a white flower and a purple flower and you mix them, you will not get a light purple. You will get a purple and a white flower as a result, if you're going to. So there's no blending of the traits. They stand by themselves. So for instance, if you had a wrinkled pea, and then a smooth pea, and then mix the two, you would not have semi-smooth and semi-rough peas. You would have the wrinkled, or you would have the smooth. You wouldn't get it blending. So we have a uniform sexual reproduction. And that's important for the experiments that he conducted. Now, Gregor Mendel, as we said, was a Catholic priest and a scientist. He was a monk. He was an Augustinian monk. So he believed in the premises of St. Augustine. And some genetic terms that we need to talk about. It's going to be, first of all, allele. An allele is going to be an alternative form of a gene trait. Now, as we mentioned in the very beginning when I talked about that couple who has since, they're still here, they're out in the surf playing with their son. He's building a little sandcastle with his little bucket. It's cute. And as I've said, you know, the kid has a thinness about him, like the mother. But he also has his father's darker hair. So those would be two traits that would be called alleles. The mother has light hair, blonde hair, and the father has dark hair. And because there's an alternative form of the same gene, that would be considered an allele, black hair, and then also the blonde hair. Now, for example, the one allele creates dark eyes and another could create blue eyes, or as we just said, dark hair or blonde hair. Now the gene is going to be the information, the unit of information for a specific trait. So on the chromosome, which is going to be really the area, there's going to be a gene. And that gene then can have an alternative gene, and that's going to be called an allele. Each gene has a specific location. We call it a locus. And that was one of the reasons why, I don't know whether you remember, but in like year 2000 or so, they were very excited because they actually had mapped the human genome. That means they found the places for all of our genes, which is pretty exciting. Each gene has a specific location, or as we said, that locus. It's going to be on the chromosome. And genes control the production of protein. When I looked at that kid, I saw that he had dark hair, and that means that his genes are making a protein that makes his hair dark. So when his hair comes out, the proteins are in such a way that they are dark. Whereas his proteins also are making his bone and his skin and everything else to make himself thinner. Whereas his protein could make himself bigger, like his father. But in this case, his protein, his genes, are dictating what kind of protein to make, either dark protein for his hair, or in the case of his mother, you know, she has protein that is made blonde. So that's why that she's got blonde hair. Her genes are controlling the production of that blonde gene or that blonde protein. So our whole body is, of course, made of protein. So the shape of our nose is because of the shape of protein. Our height, our eye color, our skin color, our organs, our whatever you can imagine in the whole body is going to be dictated by the genes because they're going to tell the protein where to go. When we look at an allele, we can see that there's going to be homologous chromosomal pairs. Each allele is going to be on either side of these homologous chromosomal pairs. You got one pair, or you got one of the pair from your mother, and you got one of the pair from your father. So you put them together and you get the homologous chromosomal pairs, and homologous means similar. So when we look at the idea of this black hair and blonde hair, as we talked about with the kid in front of me, who's, by the way, building a nice castle. I mean, you know, he's got his little bucket and he's filled the sand in there. He's doing a good job. There are terms that most people know, and they're going to be dominant and recessive. Dominant means it's something that's going to be expressed, and the recessive is going to be something that is repressed. So when we look at the kid, we see he has dark hair, but within him is also going to be blonde hair, because his mother is blonde. So his dominant trait is going to be dark hair, but he will have a trait within him being blonde hair, which is going to be recessive or not expressed. Now, it's possible that when he gets married to another, you know, individual, obviously. Of course, that's what happens when you get married. But when he gets married and he has kids, it's possible he could have a blonde-haired kid, even though he married a dark-haired kid. Because it's possible that the dark hair of him and the dark hair of his wife, once they get together, she could have had what he had, which is a recessive blonde trait. So here's these two dark-haired people, and they have a blonde-haired kid. And that certainly is possible, genetically speaking. So when we look at a dominant trait, we see that it's going to be represented by a capital letter. So anytime you see a capital letter in genetics, it's always going to be the dominant trait. A recessive trait is going to be with a small letter. So anytime you see a small letter, you know that's going to be a recessive trait. So in this example of our kid, him having dark hair, and his mother having blonde hair, so his father's trait would be a big B for black hair, and that would be the dominant trait. We would say then a small B would be representative of the mother's blonde hair, which is a recessive trait. Now, we could sit around and be geneticists and say to each other, well, I have a big B and a small B, or a big B and a big B, or a small B and a small B, and after a while, sounds like we're kindergartners. So we got to, you know, make this a little bit more scientific. So we don't say big B, or big P, or small P, big P, whatever. What we do say is, we either say homozygous, for if we mean big P, or small P, or if we mean big B, or small B, we'll call it homozygous. And then if we're talking about both of the traits together, big B, small B, like the kid is, he's big B, small B, then we would say he was heterozygous. So the child is heterozygous. We don't know what the parents are, but at least the father, we know, is going to be either homozygous, dominant, or he could be homozygous, or he could be heterozygous. He's either heterozygous, or he's homozygous dominant. Now notice that I added a term to homozygous, and that was the term dominant. There's also a homozygous recessive. There is not that in heterozygous, because heterozygous is either a big letter and a small letter. So homozygous recessive would mean that both alleles are small letters. Homozygous dominant would mean that both alleles or both letters are going to be large letters. So what I just said was is that the kid is heterozygous because we know that he's got a combination of his father, which is going to be the big B, and his mother, which is going to be the small B, because he's got blonde in him, although he did not express blonde. Now the mother is easy. She's got blonde hair, and that's a recessive trait. So she must be homozygous recessive. That means she has two small Bs. Whereas the father could be homozygous dominant, in other words, he's got two big Bs, or he could be heterozygous. If he's heterozygous, then he has a big B, and if you combine that with the small B of the mother, then it's possible that big B could come across and manifest. Or is it? No, that's not possible. And we'll show you that why. It's probably that the father has to be homozygous dominant. And I'll share that with you later when we talk about the Punnett square. But we'll be able to figure that out and see what the genetics of the father may be. Now, when we talk about big P, small P, big P, small P together, when we say homozygous dominant, homozygous recessive, heterozygous, what we're really talking about is genotype. So genotype is what is not being able to be seen. It refers to the genes. So it's what's underneath the surface. Once we see something, we call it a phenotype. That's what we can see. If we know it. If we know it because it's going to be an actual trait. So phenotype is going to be a trait, and the genotype is going to be what's unseen. So that's enough for now. We'll talk later on another Biology on the Beach. Bye now.